Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work, people who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Kim Walker. I'm the Senior Director and Head of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Arabella Advisors. So grateful to have you with us for this conversation, and really pleased to be able to introduce our guest, Marcus Walton, who is the President and CEO of GEO, Rentmakers for Effective Organizations. The conversation that Marcus and I had was a really important one to both of us as Black folks working in philanthropy, as people who think deeply about the practice and implementation of racial equity. And we actually timed it to make sure that we could comment on and begin processing the verdict of the Derek Chauvin trial. And so you'll hear that at the beginning of our conversation today. We'll talk about that in addition to Marcus's personal story and his views on social change. Marcus and I spoke via Zoom, and I'm really excited to be able to share the interview with you. Please enjoy. Marcus, thanks so much for being willing to do this today. It's good to see you. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Yes, me too. My seatbelt is on.
I feel like I want to start with what I'm sure is on both of our minds as Black people working in this space. And that's really, we are just a few days out from having heard the Chauvin verdict. And I would just love to hear from you kind of where you're at with that. How are you feeling about it? How is it sitting with you? What's happening for you?
Okay. Thank you. And if I may, there's a way in which we talk a lot about how things can and should be, and we don't model it. And so the exchange becomes a little superficial, maybe intellectual.
Yep.
I'd like to use this opportunity to both share and model a different way. And so first and foremost, in honor of that question, I'll respond to that question directly, verbally, but also as a demonstration of a culturally responsive approach to leadership, including philanthropic leadership. I'd like to first acknowledge the generation of people, multiple generations across multiple cultural backgrounds, who have fought, who have died, who have given up hope, who have tucked the last of the money into their children's shirt pocket on the way to school so they can have something to eat, right? These experiences that so many of us across so many cultural identities have, that have not had the benefited from the privilege and access to opportunity as others. I want to acknowledge them and offer gratitude for all of the different sacrifices, all of the unfulfilled hopes, all of the deferred dreams that have contributed to me being able to speak on behalf of this broader community. First and foremost, I have to say that anything that I offer, it's not from me. It's a result of everything that I've experienced, including what I've heard from the community of colleagues that make up the ecosystem of Grantmakers for Effective Organizations. And I believe that philanthropy has the power and influence to reach people outside of that ecosystem too. And so I speak not only to the ecosystem of GEO, but to that broader audience as well. And the end goal is to reimagine what thriving might look like for society today. Every person in society, every person who is contributing in some way to this system, reimagining it to be more inclusive of the pluralistic, multi-ethnic democracy that is that we aspire for.
Thank you for that. That's so powerful.
Yeah. So with that as the context then, and thank you for allowing that.
Of course.
And see, everyone, it just took me a couple of minutes to do that. Like, we can start everything with that. Like,
yeah.
That's a ritual.
Yeah. And
every culture has rituals, including the dominant culture that we've been socialized into that mm-hmm. tends to be dehumanizing for so many people. But I digress. We'll get into that a little bit more. But the manner in which I've experienced the verdict and the surrounding violence that reflects back to the underlying issue of the George Floyd trial is that perhaps change is possible on some level. I don't know that we've, in our lifetime, certainly in my lifetime, 49 years, I've never experienced this kind of result before. That's significant. And so I have to acknowledge that in order to deal with things as they are. And whatever the outcome, that was a symptom of something that is underlying, a condition that is perpetual and represents the impact of a long lineage of policies and practices that have worked against communities, that has done so much harm to so many communities, in part to preserve the power and privilege of a smaller group. And so it reinforces for me the real work. It reminds me that to give up hope and not try guarantees that we won't get a different result. And it keeps me connected to a broader range. Like, it really forces me to lean into my community, however I define that, loved ones, colleagues, and breathe into that, because there's no way I could deal with all of the different things surrounding that verdict, all of the uncertainty leading up to it, and still tend to everything else in life, bringing my fullest and best self to it without that kind of support. And so going it alone is something that doesn't serve any of us in our work, or quite frankly, in our lives. Like, we're here to experience joy, right?
Yes.
And perhaps at the center of philanthropy is joy, which I believe we have an opportunity to reclaim, because our focus has been off a little bit, diverted along the way, away from joy.
I just, thank you for sharing that. I feel like, you know, a few days out, it's so fresh in some ways. It feels, I know for me, a little bit difficult to process, but a lot of what you just said resonates with my own experience of it. And I also really value you raising this point, actually a couple of points about joy and community, which I know in my conversations with folks, those are things that people are seeking, are needing, perhaps more than ever before. And just knowing what I do about kind of your background and your work, I feel like those have been really central themes for you and your own journey in the philanthropic space. Can you talk a little bit about that, how those themes have kind of showed up in your work and in your life?
Yeah, you know, the first thing I have to say is, listen, my highest aspiration for this conversation, the reason that I'm engaged in this work of philanthropy, working in the sector that we work in, is to support the elevation of our collective well-being, right? Our collective consciousness. I want all human beings to thrive, right? And it is it's an ongoing challenge for me to hold thriving. And by hold, I mean like embody thriving within a structure that was not designed for the majority to thrive. So now we're talking about design mismatch, right?
Yep.
It's more than dissonance. In order to respond to the question with integrity, I have to say that so much of my career, which involves being a community organizer, and even before that, as a college student, being engaged in fraternal organizations because I cared about leadership. I admired Dr. Martin Luther King and others who thought about this broader sense of thriving, that's beloved community, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I believed it. I chose to believe it, and I dared to carve a path that would somehow fulfill my own aspirations to experience this. And so when entering philanthropy, which like so many of us at the time, back 20 years ago, there was no clear pathway into philanthropy. You just kind of end up there, right? And so I went from an organizer and working in community in the South Bronx. So like this is one of the more challenging census tracts in the entire nation when it came to health indicators. And I didn't have disparities language yet. I'm just saying like we knew conditions were bad, right?
Yeah.
Relative to other places on a map. Mm-hmm. Right? And so with that experience, I wanted to go back home. I wanted to go back to Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I'm from. And
me
practice.
Too, by the way.
Oh my gosh. See, there you go. And so I was able to go back to the Cleveland Foundation and become a program officer. And they created a thing. Ron Richard, who's still there, and props to Ron for having enough foresight to say, like, we got to diversify this thing. We have to do some things. He was trying to shake it up. He mm-hmm. created a thing called the responsive grant making. In a department. And so I was a generalist whose role was to form a different level of relationship, presence of the foundation in the communities. Mm-hmm. Right? And these were the communities that I had grown up in and still have family there. And so that was like incredibly powerful and so heartbreaking because the vision was bigger than where the organization was at the time. And I say that with all respect. Mm-hmm. Right. And these are the early days of what we now refer to on a regular basis, probably on a daily basis, as equity and all of that. Like that was nascent.
Yeah.
And so certainly there wasn't a large body of work and a large group of practitioners with whom we could connect and learn more about. And so my journey really became mostly about navigating inequitable systems. Mm. I became expert, if you will, at the navigation and didn't even think about the transformation of those systems in the way that I've only been able to embrace in the past 5 years or so. Right? Mm. And so it has taken courage, Kim. It has taken so much courage for me to think about the imperative of leaders, right? That is different from a manager. Managers operate in the known, in the familiar, focus on efficiency. Leaders yep. operate in the unknown, right? Mm-hmm. The growth zone, and focus on effectiveness, right?
Yep.
Impact. And so I had to do all of the things, familiarize myself and master management in order to get to leadership. And then from leadership, continue to cultivate the courage to dare to do the thing that the moment it was asking for. Like you said, the people want to know about community. How can we become more connected to the thing? People want to know about joy. How can I experience more of this? How can mm-hmm. I, my well-being be served by the thing that you're talking about, right? And it was painful. Quite frankly, the wins were gratifying. The relationships run deep. My network is national, maybe even international. My experience has been two steps forward, perhaps in one step back, and fraught with the kind of uncertainty that I have come to appreciate as a part of leadership, but that I didn't always respond to with grace and care for myself. Mm. So yeah, it was real. It was real.
I think what I'm hearing and what you're saying is this necessity to reimagine. So as you're talking about kind of navigating versus transforming, and this is something I feel like I've gone through as well, is really opening up the boundaries of your thinking, understanding, you know, I think a lot about this idea of kind of mental models that we have about things, what we accept as is part of how we operate.
Yes.
And I think what you're really speaking to is that this work requires getting outside of your mental models, which you may have had your entire life. Really, the courage that you're speaking to, I think, is so key to that. That because that transformation work is much harder, is much more uncertain.
Yeah. If I may, I mean, let me lay it out for you. You asked a very specific, like, straightforward question, and I'm giving you something that is layered. I'm aware of that, and I think it's so important. We're from Cleveland, so I grew up in a working class environment. That includes a particular relationship with money, right? Mm-hmm. Is it scarcity? Is it abundance? Mm-hmm. Is it a mindset of plenty or a mindset of how do we connect the dots, a zero-sum game? If there's more here, then that means there's less here, right? That's a part of one of those mental models, right?
Yep.
There's also this notion of like, okay, now, if I'm honest with myself, the people that groomed me, that reared me, the people that made me who I am today, the earliest community that I can remember was so loving, so expansive. I mean, it was like family. Remember, I had a large family. My mom had 11 brothers and sisters. My dad had 11 brothers and sisters. So like the community was like blood relatives, first and foremost. Every weekend, that was it. I was good. But there was also Miss Jones, who lived next to my grandmother, whose house I could go in without knocking on the door, right? Mm-hmm. And there was other people on around the corner, same way. And so that kind of, when you know, beloved community I mentioned earlier, I truly grew up in one. I truly saw what it means to care for where people would share butter and cheese. Like, come on, right? Like, this is real. This is real. That's philanthropy. That's the spirit of philanthropy. We are talking about an institutional form of that, right? Wow. It's really about our collective humanity that we're talking about. And so with the love and care that I was raised, I also saw people who said, well, I don't know if this investment in education is really the best use of your time. You don't necessarily need that. We didn't need it. And look, we have a house. You have five cousins living here. Like, see what I'm saying? And so like that mental model was one that I had to challenge too. And when I broke away from that and said, well, you know, this education thing seems like it's important, then I had to experience the isolation of that. Now I'm operating outside of the norms and values of the community that reared me and provided me with unconditional love. Which I also associate with philanthropy too. To what extent are we institutionally providing an unconditional connection to the people that we're serving? I think we're letting people down in community when it comes to that as grant makers and as a sector. And so I say all of this to say, I watched those same people when I went off and to pursue those academic, you know, goals, I also saw the community deteriorate, right? Because the auto industry, the steel mills were becoming global, right? And so now there's an economic impact, a shrinkage that was already contributing to a scarcity thinking when it came to money that's just associated with class in general, right? And like any kind of physical deterioration that happened around the nation, physical deterioration of our communities and neighborhoods, in came the drugs, right? And then came the physical deterioration of the very people who showed me unconditional love and allowed me to enjoy privileges that some people will never experience in their lifetime.
Yeah.
That's the reality of my experience, Kim.
Yeah, I mean, you're speaking to so many things there that I think are important. I think the levels of identity that we bring into the work that we do, I mean, even just the parts of yourself you shared there, seeing those in context of philanthropy and how they might interact with that. And I think what you spoke to is frankly how I would see philanthropy operating at its best, is creating this kind of unconditional loving community. And I know we're both passionate about kind of what can we do within this sector to get to that place.
Yes.
And I'd be really curious to hear from you, particularly as it relates to racial equity. What have we learned and what have we not yet learned that we need to learn to move this forward? What are we missing?
I love it. I can't wait to hang out with you more after these conversations. But what did we learn from racial equity? Let me first offer a definition for racial equity. The definition, let me offer this. This kind of focus on racial equity, and I referred to it a little earlier, that's now a mainstream consideration that was really catalyzed from my observation last year over the summer with the incident around George Floyd and the kind of global awakening. Mm-hmm. And I'm calling it an awakening.
Yeah.
My experience is that within this context now, there's some question marks, some big questions around like, hey, when do we go back to a normal? Right? We're all seeking this thing called normal. We're all now wondering, we're talking about reimagining. There's some tables where people are saying that, what's the new normal look like? What I offer is that we moved from a place of knowing to now sharing an unknown. Now we are all in the unknown together. Ambiguity completes the cycle, every stage, right? And that may be a blessing in disguise because now we have a shared experience, right? Which the previous system, which I'll say beneath is a very real and invisible caste system, right? Where the dominant class has a set of rules and expectations and a very explicit and evolving norms for allowing people in. And there's a broader set of expectations for who should not be in that class and who is more subordinate. And various identities get pushed into the subordinate category, but it's especially reinforced by this notion of race, which is not real.
Right.
So the first part of my defining of racial equity is that there's only one race. It's a human race. And it's comprised of a variety, a multitude, a cornucopia, if you will, of cultures and ethnicities and all types of expressions of our collective humanity that are bound by norms, that are bound by belief systems, that are bound by rituals, practices, attitudes, mindsets, all types of things that make up our culture, right? And so first and foremost, I want to say there's only one race. The reason we use racial for equity, at least at GEO, is that it's already been proven over years and years of uncomfortable, unproductive conversations that whenever we have a conversation that involves race today, race tends to fall off the table as a variable for measure. And we gravitate toward class and education level. Isn't this really about class, right? That kind of a thing. Or gender, right? Or gender. But what the data shows us is that, and this is about disaggregating data, like using the data to drive decision making. But the data shows us if we get the most nuanced picture of who we're serving as grant makers, is that it's predictable by race, by categories of this imaginary distinction between people, which has become real within the American caste system, that we can determine a person's quality of life according to those categories. In other words, the browner the population, the worse off they tend to be when it comes to a variety of indicators of well-being, health, achievement, otherwise. And so equity, racial equity, and it's important to say that this is one point of view.
Yeah.
Because there's no large body of work over 100 years that's tried and true, right? No, there's a group of individuals and there's some well-known individuals who have been working diligently to test some principles, to organize some thoughts, to develop research. And now the process of racial equity practice is about kind of knitting together these pieces of work and reports and products into something that makes sense and is responsive to a particular circumstance that is shared by the lead organization around this, whatever work, racial equity work a group is attempting to commit to or define for themselves. And so, so I offer only my experience. Right. No secondhand information. My promise is that I'm giving you what I know to be true. And I do it with curiosity because this requires us to take a mindset of more curiosity and less certainty. Right. Certainty is the enemy. It is the thing that will undo all of our best intentions when it comes to racial equity work. And so in a nutshell, racial equity can be easily defined as, and not restricted by this, but defined by taking a historical analysis of the conditions today and understanding how policies that have been enacted over time have contributed to current conditions. And when I talk about current conditions, I'm talking about disparities, differences in life experience according to issues that really characterize the major domains of life on a daily basis. So educational achievement, we talked about education, professional achievement, I talked about that before, but there's other things, access to opportunities, the quality of schools, right? Suspension rates within schools, who tends to, right? All of those things. So hopefully you see how this connects back. And this is across every industry. I could do it with housing and say like, what's been the story of housing? What about wealth disparities? The wealth gap between different populations. In every one of these areas, you name the thing. I wish we could take questions from the audience and in the chat, because I can name a disparity that's connected to a set of policies that at some point, whether they were race explicit or race neutral, had an impact on the extent to which groups that are categorized according to the constructs of race, which are political and social in nature only, right? Not biological, again, it's only one, right? That these the construct of race can determine one's well-being. Right? And so the practice of racial equity is to do everything in our power to super simplify this thing, use the power at our disposal, whether it's positional or individually held, inherent in our being, to undo the policies that cause harm, reverse the practices that are causing and perpetuating harm, and replace them with policies and practices that are affirming, that are humanizing, that are welcoming to everyone that's contributing to a particular system or structure or institution or organization. That's racial equity practice. And it's intersectional. It's not just saying, let's make sure that BIPOC communities are doing better. Like, no, that is the lowest hanging fruit. We should be doing that anyway, right? Racial equity practices saying different populations for historical reasons, experiences over time, are faring in different ways around different issues. And so we want to respond with an analysis. We want to disaggregate data. We want to focus on root cause, for example. We want to exercise power in a way I described about changing policies and practices in a manner that responds to the particular needs of every group, of as many as we can possibly identify. It's appreciating difference and nuance in order to inform our investments. It's intersectional. It's not just about race. It's making sure that race is always included in every analysis, whether it's a gender analysis, which we absolutely need to do in this nation as well, right? Because all genders are not doing the same within each category, right? It's the same across age. It's the same across education level. It's the same across class. It's the same across sexual orientation, abilities, immigration status, right? Citizenship. All of these things are identifying categories that are valuable to help us make the most targeted investment in order to have the biggest, most meaningful impact.
And are you seeing folks in philanthropy, A, understand that? Because what you just shared, I think, is a really comprehensive and helpful definition of equity, and I think does a great job of situating this concept at the structural level. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing folks really engage with that productively in philanthropy? And are you seeing places where folks are maybe not productively engaging with that? I mean, I think one of the critiques this sector gets
come
often
on,
is
come
that,
on.
Yeah,
let's go. Let's go.
I mean, this sector is built on inequity, right? And when we talk about things like wealth disparities, philanthropy to many people is an example of just that. And so this idea that from within this space of philanthropy, we are now going to do racial equity work. How do we balance that with the reality of the space that we're working in, which is perhaps a manifestation of that same inequity?
Absolutely. Very well said. And so you just named the question that characterizes the contemporary moment.
Mm.
How do we, as a part of every sector, private sector, right? Civic sector, right, in government, in similar institutions, how do we advance this philosophy in some ways of fairness and inclusiveness that engages every population? Again, the multi-ethnic, pluralistic democracy that we all are aspiring for. That is the question.
Yep.
And so one response, and it's aspirational, because that, you know, the answer to your question is that we're at the infancy, we're at the most nascent stages of really addressing this in earnest.
Yeah,
right? You know, we're reading White Fragility and all of those, like, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on the book.
I got you.
The body of work, but what I'm saying is that it's so much bigger than that. That this is about transforming the systems that exist because they were designed to produce the results that for the broadest group of populations are no longer sufficient. For whatever reason, in this awakening, we have agreed that the status quo is insufficient.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So now the challenge is, and for philanthropy and broadly, right? Philanthropy can't do this alone. It is not the scaling entity that's required to transform society. But within philanthropy, there's enough influence, there's enough financial resources, and there are enough coordinated networks in order to change the narrative, establish a shared vision for what it means to thrive, right?
Mm.
To look inwardly and start to develop the kinds of cultures, like cultivate the work environment that reflect on the micro, where we're looking to experience in the macro, right?
Mm.
And just like I told you, it's gonna require some courageous leadership because that blueprint has not been defined yet.
Mm.
It hasn't been. And so what I encourage, which I also heard of kind of, I'm implying from your question, what I'm encouraging is in the same way that I just gave you a framework that looked at the structures, the structural dynamics of equity and how we might engage in this work. I'm also saying that I believe it serves us to look at the personal impact of inequity on every individual, including those who have benefited from the privilege.
Mm.
Because believing that we are superior to another human being is also a distorted mindset that has negative implications. And primarily, the negative implications go to the core of how change happens, which is about establishing trust, relationships that are based on trust, that are defined by trust, understanding that trust, that speed, that change happens at the speed of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so the currency of change is trust. And yet, if I believe I'm superior to you, I can't engage you, and I'm not even necessarily interested in being in a genuine, generative, authentic relationship with you. So instead, my relationships become at an arm's length with you. Right? Mm-hmm. Instead, I have a charitable mindset as opposed to a partnership that is facilitating and catalyzing change. Right. And so we have to commit to change. And to commit to change means, from my experience, that story that I just told, is that at some point in that journey, I had to be willing to be transformed and shaped by the experiences that I encountered. Mm. Not me. I'm not imposing any kind of thinking like, hey, here's my thought and I'm going to make that happen. I had to say, here are the people with whom I want to thrive. I want to establish trusting relationships. I want to heal. I want to support through healing. And I'm willing to bring my whole self, be all in for change and be shaped by whatever that process entails. That's what I believe we need right now.
I'm just struck by how much of what you just said also applies at kind of every level, right? When I think about, especially we're talking about this on an individual level, but within mm-hmm. philanthropy as well, this is a shift we're trying to make, working That's from right. trust and partnership.
That's right.
Rather right. than from transactional, perhaps even extractive work yes. together.
Yes. I love a colleague of mine. I wish I could get this quote right. But the way he described it was philanthropy, the positions we hold in philanthropy are illegitimate, right? Mm. He was describing the paradox of being in the privileged position of investing in the well-being of individuals within communities, and pointing out the structural, the design, the historic barriers of institutional philanthropy, and naming that the accumulation of these dollars were done in an extractive way. And mm-hmm. by extension, even the position that we hold here is illegitimate on some level. And so mm-hmm. we have to just, what I'm saying here is, acknowledging the complexity of the reality is the first step. Mm. We don't necessarily have to figure it out. The desire to come up with a solution is actually driven by the dynamics and norms of the system within which we've been socialized, right? Some people refer to it as the white dominant cultural norms and values that I described yeah. earlier have actually dehumanized, have only served to harm. Why is that? Because whiteness isn't real. Mm. Whiteness is the construct that we're pushing up against. Mm. People are just having different experiences as a result of the construction and promotion of this thing referred to as whiteness. And the tricky challenge over the years is that we continue to get the concept of whiteness confused with people who refer to themselves or are referred to as white people. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as white people. That's an agreement that we make to support how we identify ourselves. But it really speaks to what I mentioned before, the underlying caste system and who's dominant within that and who's subordinate. So people who are not associated with whiteness, who have mm-hmm. not agreed to promote or assimilate into the norms and standards established by the imaginary construction of whiteness, then become disposed, literally discarded into the subordinate class.
Yeah.
Right. So it's I'm naming this because I mentioned joy and community at the onset of this conversation. Mm-hmm. And so in order for us to get to joy and be in authentic community with each other, in order for us to acknowledge each other's shared humanity and establish a shared vision for what it means to thrive as a collective body, we have to unpack the things that separate us from each other. And this invisible system that operates beneath the surface of inequity, this caste system makes some people believe, it serves at the core of a person's belief of inferiority, which is internalized sometimes,
mm-hmm.
or superiority.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both my work and yours. Because if I believe the hype, if I believe the messages that I'm getting through all of the different systems and all of the different experiences that I have again, when I bump up against those systems, that I'm doing something wrong, something must be wrong with me because I'm not getting a satisfactory result, or I'm behind when it comes to other groups. If I don't have the analysis, I start to believe that something maybe is wrong with me. Maybe it's something wrong with people who look and speak and talk like me too. Then it's impossible for me to relate with you, which is why racial healing work is also critical to the work of philanthropy, in my opinion. Healing, making amends, reconciliation, right? And exploration of truth is critical for considering steps to move forward. How do we move forward? How do we establish a new normal? From my experience and opinion, is that it must include attention to supporting people to acknowledge the trauma, work through trauma, traumatic experiences from inequity, sometimes mm-hmm. practices, sometimes intentional, sometimes not, right? So that they can show up as whole, so that they can address their own mental models, right?
Mm-hmm.
I understand how we may be holding ourselves back before another person even becomes an actor in the space.
Mm-hmm.
That's the impact of inequitable systems and why racial equity matters so much.
Yeah. I'm just kind of absorbing that. I feel like to what you're speaking to really well is just power to me at the end of the day.
Power.
Who has power? How do we get power?
What's our relationship to power?
Mm-hmm.
Because we might not be acknowledging power that we actually have access to at any given moment. But let's at least exhaust that power and then start to explore other forms of power. But absolutely, absolutely.
What would you say to other folks like you who are leaders in this space who maybe haven't come to some of these conclusions yet, are struggling to do the work, are struggling to define what the work is?
Mm-hmm.
What should they be thinking about? What should they be surrounding themselves with to get to this place?
First and foremost, become we.
Mm.
Plug into another person or set of people who are in similar stages of the journey or maybe a little ahead, right? Because alone, and this is a cultural expression too, we go faster alone, further together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this notion of independent knowing, right? Defining ourselves by how brilliant we are. Again, that's socialization from this dominant cultural context that we have a chance to reimagine, right? Instead, mm-hmm. let's make it cultural, a culturally responsive and relevant dynamic that says, you grew up just like I did with a group of people. Maybe it wasn't your family in the same way, but there's some group of people in most of our experiences that imparted wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
That represented a source of comfort and encouragement, right? We get to draw from those cultural experiences and make that the new normal. Like being receptive of every individual's expression of cultural wisdom allows us to tap into our collective genius, which is why we don't want to go it alone. The collective genius is, I believe it holds exactly what this moment requires because it always has in any other situation, scenario in history. So what is different about this? I should not think that anything is different about this situation right now. And so if we consider, explore, entertain, like just keep open the possibility that something about our collective genius it's connected to, dare I say, our salvation. Then I encourage practitioners today to hang in there, to embrace grappling, to do the personal work that around our emotions. We call it our self-mastery, like establish a practice of sorting through your emotions, grounding yourself both physically and emotionally, right? Connecting with colleagues that you admire and respect, right? To maintain a posture of humility and vulnerability. And then dare to lead, show up in service of shared aspirations with authenticity and integrity, including the things about which you have no idea how to respond, right? Declaring that and instead showing up as curious, asking questions into those spaces and allowing the collective genius of the group to respond to the question. Yeah, easier said than done, but accessible, you know, doable at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this theme of the collective just keeps showing up over and over in our conversation. And I think for really good reason, for really good reason.
Now, Kim, I suspect there are those who feel like, man, I still wish there was just like three things that we could do. Like, I want some step. I want to offer that too. I want to offer that too.
I love it.
So as we get to that bigger picture thing, we can also fund and support advocacy, right? Let's consider that the people closest to an issue have the best insights into resolutions for those issues. And so for campaigns around any policies or any kind of activities, initiatives that are advancing a particular policy, especially a policy change, your philanthropy can be leveraged. Like, use your philanthropy as leverage to support those advocacy efforts that aligned with the end goal of any particular investment, right? That's one. Mm-hmm. And that's going to require us to educate ourselves, right? Yep. We need to establish, once again, more relationships to appreciate the breadth of work that's happening in a particular place. We also want to disaggregate data. Whenever you collect data, and just think about data differently. Let's take a step back from disaggregation. From the onset of data collection, include community, include the group that you hope to serve with your investment. Right? Yep. First and foremost, and do it at every stage of a process. From conceptualization, do that with some folks that are part of the group you're hoping to serve. Let them inform that thing. When it comes to implementation, have them at the table to think about implementation and all of the different dynamics and components of implementation. And then when it comes to evaluation, have them as a part of that to define progress, right? To literally contribute to the definition of progress. This is how we want to define success in this initiative. And then any kind of communication, include them in the dissemination of that information. So engaging communities is critical. Communities are a part of the collective wisdom and genius that we sometimes don't avail ourselves of within institutions, because institutions can become quite insular quite quickly, right? Mm-hmm. And so to stave off myopia, we want to include as many partners from outside of the institution to inform the decisions that we're making within it.
Mm-hmm.
And then last but not least, I would say provide flexible multi-year funding. Especially for those groups. Like, we could talk about trust-based philanthropy. We could talk about purpose-driven board leadership. We can talk about community-driven philanthropy. I've already described a kind of equity-centered approach to philanthropy. But all of these things at the end of the day really encourage us to remove barriers that are unnecessary that may have historically been put in place to intentionally separate the grant maker, the funder, the wealthy, the elite from the masses.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, just I love the design term, form follows function, right? The calculus, right? The form of philanthropy should follow the function of philanthropy that we have in mind. Right now it doesn't. And so let's tap into our power boards, trustees, right? CEOs, even VPs, right? Let's decide to prioritize a reimagining of the structure of institutional philanthropy to be more responsive in the ways that we talked about today to the needs, the different experiences of that pluralistic, multi-ethnic, vibrant democracy that's just waiting to be engaged and embraced.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for giving everyone a little bit of what they need, some of the ambiguous work to claw through, and then some of those bullet points. I think you're going to make everyone happy there. Did it. I guess my final question would just be, we talked so much about learning today. I know learning is very central for you. I know you coach. I know you think about learning a lot, as do I. And I also know that that's really one of the main aims of GEO, is to offer that kind of learning space. So
indeed,
did want to give you a moment to kind of talk about what I know Arabella is very excited about, the upcoming conference, May 24th to 26th, that we are proud to sponsor. And what would you share with folks about how to approach that learning space, and how that connects to some of the conversation we had today?
I love it. And thank you so much for asking. What I described to you today, and I tried to avoid all of the labels and the jargon, I described what it means for us to enter into these spaces with a mindset of learning, right?
Yep.
To be learning leaders. And so we already know how to show up in these spaces with curiosity, right? Suspending the urge to know. Everyone's so brilliant. That's one of the amazing things about philanthropy. We're all educated in so many different things in so many different ways that sometimes that gets in the way, right? So we want to create space. I'm going to refer to it as spaciousness is the goal. GEO creates spaciousness to allow for learning. And if I dare go to the kind of metaphysical edge, the limits of this, we create space for revelation. The revelation of the wisdom that is inherent within our collective genes. And so GEO has a 20-year history, a refined process of creating containers that are conducive to that revelation of that collective genius. And we invite people who have some ideas and some practices in the same way that you did with me today to inform those spaces. And then we get into the critical dialogue, the questions, the whatabouts, the I'm not sure, I'm uncertain, I feel uncomfortable. All of that is in service of that revelation. It produces exactly what the group that came together requires. And so that's what we do at GEO. And we're very intentional about doing that across the broad range of challenges that inform our work in the sector. And we encourage all grant makers to see yourselves as leaders of change, informed by community. The change that we're making is in response to what communities say they need, as well as the nonprofits that support them, right? And feel free, you're welcome to be awkward. You're welcome to be at the earliest stages, to be unsure, to be uncertain, to not want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to offend. This is the space where you can actually do that. And you won't be shamed, right? You'll be embraced. You'll be met with support. You'll be met with resources to help you grapple with the complexity of what we're talking about, this work. And so GEO is about grappling with complexity and being a supportive network of peers to help other individuals move through and be shaped, dare I say, transformed by that process.
Ooh, I feel like we got full circle there. We started on transformation, we're ending on transformation. Marcus, indeed. I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. Wow. It was such a delight.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.